saying she's a pro. She's a pro.
Yes. Some would call me an old pro, which I love.
How clever of you. Well, I think like no other introduction needed because of all that recording stuff that we do in the beginning. Like, this is Yes, a Stripper podcast. We're here today with Caitlin Bailey. So we're just going to jump right into it. Hello. Please say hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my God. Beyond excited to have you. I've been like getting all of your emails because I'm on your newsletter list. And yes. And I've just heard about you for ages, eons, because you're super active, activists in the sex worker community. And like, we're just going to talk about all of that and who you are, if that's fantastic. Okay with you. Okay, great.
I would be lying if I pretended it wasn't my favorite topic.
I can tell you. Like, I watched your stand-up comedy today also. It's so funny because I started with like your professional stuff where you're like...
It's a hard jump. Yeah.
In front of like... really professional people. And then,
very serious.
I was like, oh my God, like, she's like so cool and so smart. And then I watched your comedy and I was like, oh no, she's like rad, like nothing to be worried about at all. You're so silly.
Are you calling me a dirty hoe? Is that what just happened?
Yeah, was you
that?
Are.
Yes. Okay. It's fair. Amazing. Reasonable.
Yes. No, I was like, oh my God, I can actually relate.
Yes.
Because like your other stuff, your work is so incredible and you're
Thank
doing
you.
Really incredible stuff. And you're like in front of politicians in like really important governmental type rooms.
I do feel like getting heard by the stuffies, if I can call them that, is part of my job. And right. So, yeah, thank you. I appreciate the like code switching that you see between comedy and legislators and politicians and people in academia that don't get it yet.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And speaking of not getting it, I was watching the NBC special that you shared in your newsletter.
Yes.
And the women on there that they're doing the work in that they're anti-sex work and they think that all sex workers are victims, that we're all traumatized and we only do it because we're traumatized and we're unaware. We're unaware. And that they seemed like very intelligent, and thoughtful, and well-intentioned people that I could have dinner with.
Absolutely.
But.
Right. I mean, the problem, of course, is that prostitution has become a symbol of violence against women, right? And this, you know, started, goes way back to the white slave law, which was, you know, one of our first moral panics on this issue. And like so many of these like anti-sex politics, it comes down to a moral panic often about, you know, women's socioeconomic or like literal mobility, race relations, fears around immigration, all of that gets wrapped up. And so because we're, you know, suffering after over 100 years of propaganda, convincing smart, well-meaning people that prostitution is violence against women, you get a lot of smart, well-meaning people that take the position that all prostitution is wrong. And there are also tons of people out there that have had horrific lived experience, right, in the sex industry. They faced exploitation, they faced violence, they faced the same whorephobia that we all face, and decided that the work itself was the problem, not the exploitation, not the violence, and not the whorephobia. And, you know, I understand that path. But the reality is that the more we criminalize this work, the more dangerous we make it for everyone.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And does it give our audience context for those who may have not seen the NBC special? It was very specifically about the half like decrim laws in the state of Maine. Do you want to, because you're, you know, you've been working on this.
Yes.
Do you want to kind of fill our audience in?
Yeah, absolutely. So Maine, unfortunately, late last year became the first U.S. state to officially adopt the policy that goes by many names, right? Some people call this the Swedish model or the Nordic model. I've heard people call it the feminist or the equality model. People call it the entrapment or the end demand model. But no matter what it's called, the philosophy behind this policy is that we can and should eradicate prostitution by criminalizing demand, meaning clients and also third-party facilitators. So, right. You know, what happens is, you know, they say, you know, it's all wrapped up in these like very stereotypical, obviously heteronormative ideas around sex work, right? Like all of the girls that are selling sex to filthy men are victims of, you know, misogyny. You know, their minds can't be trusted. They need to be treated like childlike victims. And the evil men who are, you know, negotiating consent or paying for sexual services are the real villains here, as are the procurers. And so the narrative is that this is a bill that will go after pimps and johns, and they make no distinction whatsoever between men who pay for sex or people who help, you know, sex workers do their job. Like, God bless right. the person who helped me set up my website and who helps me schedule things or who or helps me do security.
Your landlord. Yeah,
or my landlord or my right. roommate or my loved one, right? And they cast these folks as predators. And the problem with this policy is that, of course, it makes it impossible to distinguish between predators and clients. It reduces the negotiating power of sex workers, and everywhere this policy has been implemented, violence against sex workers goes up.
Definitely. And we see that because the clients, I don't want to use the J word, the clients are
it's
like
not accurate.
Right.
There are Johns and Janes and Jingleheimer Schmidts that are, you know, like all kinds of people
all kinds
buy
of people,
and
exactly.
sell sexual services and
right.
have for all of human history. Sex
right.
work is older than capitalism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the oldest. According
Some would
to
say.
You.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, archaeologists will quibble with you about this, but like, yes, it's older than money.
Yeah. No, totally. Because I mean, we were exchanging things before money for services,
sure.
et cetera. Yeah. Yeah. But obviously with the clients now needing to like be more cautious
Correct.
Than when the sex worker is screening the client.
It makes it impossible.
Exactly. And then the client's like, no, I don't want to give you my personal information because what if I don't know you
cop?
And you're a cop? Yeah,
right.
exactly. And so I just wanted to say that so people who are really trying to learn the Nordic
sure.
model understand exactly why it's so dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for allowing
yeah,
me
I mean,
to tangent.
I think, you know, from an inch away, it is absolutely impossible to help people that you're trying to eradicate. And so the philosophy behind the Nordic model is that we can eradicate prostitution. And so the policy is not helpful to people that depend on this work for their livelihood. And it doesn't matter where they're at on the spectrum of like choice, circumstance, or coercion, you know, disrupting that, criminalizing that, it pushes it further into like a gray or black market.
Yeah.
And, you know, we know what prohibition does to markets, right? It doesn't make them safer. But you're
work.
Absolutely right. You know, specifically with criminalization, with asymmetrical criminalization, right? When you criminalize clients instead of sex workers, you create all of these perverse incentives that really undermine all of the different ways that we have tried to keep ourselves safe over,
right.
over centuries.
Right.
Yeah.
And so this it's might be happening in more other states, right?
Unfortunately, it's a very popular policy. So, and it's specifically popular amongst legislators because of the great work that sex worker rights advocates have done for decades. They've heard good things about decriminalization, but it feels too radical. So the way that they got this bill passed in Maine is they called it partial decriminalization.
Right.
So they stole, right, all of the hard work that we've done convincing legislators that arresting sex workers is bad and wrong and leads to bad outcomes, right?
Right.
And then they made it less radical by continuing to criminalize pimps and johns, the real predator in this situation. And they did that, of course, speaking over and for sex workers who do this work.
Well, that's the thing, though. The one, the politician woman, the one that passed.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall her name?
I don't, unfortunately.
You know who I'm talking about, right?
Yes, this is the woman who really advocated for it. It was sort of like a retirement present for her. Yes, by,
and she died 5 days after the law passed.
Yeah.
Well, she claims to talk to sex workers. And that's what baffles me when I hear people in these outside of our community positions saying things like, well, the people I've talked to. So I'm like, well, who are you talking to? Because your number one ally is a sex trafficking activist who also wants to eradicate, you know,
abortion,
consensual sex work. Yes. Oh, and abortion. I didn't know that she was
Yeah, there's a ton of overlap between. Yeah, there's a lot of conflation, right? Between like trafficking has, you know, this word, it sort of depends on whether you have like a liberal or a conservative lens on it, but it can mean anything from LGBTQ content, information about contraception, right? The conflation with information about women's bodies and obscenity goes back to the Comstock laws of the 1870s. So, you know, there are a ton of folks in the anti-choice movement that, you know, are their end goal is to criminalize all pornography, but they jump on things like the Nordic model or the end demand model as a way of suppressing prostitution.
Right. And maybe also like some of us see it and we're like, oh, partial decrim, that sounds great. And then we're just kind of like let our guard drop a little.
Correct.
Is kind of what I'm seeing. I feel like it's a mind game, like they're mind gaming
us.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
I was just going to ask, do we know what other states that are thinking of doing this?
Massachusetts is considering it, but they're also considering full decriminalization. New York is considering it. They're also considering full decriminalization. So you often have, and I think this is a great learning opportunity for many of our legislators, right? When you have these bills that go up, you know, sort of back to back, it's a wonderful opportunity for our activists to explain the important differences between, you know, I hate to adopt their language, but what's being sold to them as a partial decriminalization bill versus a full decriminalization bill. And, you know, they'll often play with language, right? We like to use safety and health. They like to use safety and health. So it can be genuinely confusing for legislators that don't have deep knowledge on this subject. And it's up to sex worker rights advocates to educate our elected officials, to educate ourselves about how to talk about this in a persuasive way. And we have to play the long game. My prediction is that similar to the age verification laws that we see popping up all over the country around pornography, we're going to see a similar trend with end demand laws. And so, you know, sex worker advocates on the ground need to be documenting the way that these policies are hurting us physically, socially, psychologically, so that we can educate our communities and lawmakers. I don't think any of this is getting fixed tomorrow.
Oh, God, no.
Yeah.
No, this is like a lifetime of work. Like it has been from all the people that came before us.
Yeah. This is multi-generational labor, guys.
Yeah.
Reclaim your legacy. We are in it.
Yeah, and will be for like another couple hundred years, maybe.
For sure.
Hopefully, God, not that long, but yeah. Age verification. You've been talking about that lately.
Yes.
Do you want to?
Sure. I mean, it's another example of a law that sounds like a good idea, right? Who supports children watching pornography, right? Zero people.
Right.
And yet, from, you know, an inch away, if you look behind the curtain, the stated intent of many of the of the advocates that are pushing for these laws, their goal isn't just to prevent children from seeing pornography. It's to erase pornography from the accessible internet, right? We are losing the free internet. You know, I think it's also important to understand that this is the same coalition that's fighting for end demand laws, criminalization. It's a combination of feminists who believe that all sex work is violence against women, right? This comes from the porn wars of the 1970s and also the 1870s and probably the 1770s. And also, you know, more explicitly anti-sex conservatives that are a little bit more transparent about what their actual goals are. And this coalition, you know, criminalized not just, you know, prostitution and pornography in the 1860s, but also alcohol and abortion. And we did it all in the name of protecting women. And so that same coalition is really threatening our ability to share information about our bodies, you know, sexual health, because all of it can be banned in the name of obscenity, of these obscenity laws are protecting children from information.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because like when we were growing up, for instance, we were we grew up without the internet, right?
And yeah, we grew up without the internet when being gay was still illegal most places. Yeah.
Yeah, and we were learning about sex from like our parents, who weren't very good at talking about it, at least mine weren't. I
or statistically doing it.
yeah. And or school, which was horrible, horrid, right? And so I wasn't taught proper, were you?
No, I came of age during George W. Bush's abstinence-only education program. So we actually had like a Southern Baptist minister's wife come to our school and give a presentation. And I remember specifically two things. One, she put glue on a piece of paper and then stuck another piece of paper to it and then tore it apart and was like, this is what happens to your body when you have sex with people. You leave pieces of yourself all over them.
Oh my God, how dramatic.
Yeah. And then I remember also we were in middle school, right? Which is like, I think scientifically the most awkward age. And she brought the, she asked for volunteers, right? She gave us no information about what we were volunteering for because consent was not a part of this education. She brings this young, like seventh grader up on stage, asked her to squeeze toothpaste out of a toothpaste container. Thank you. I'm like, what is a box? I don't know. It's not. Anyway. And then in front of everyone was like, now put the toothpaste back in the tube. That's how your virtue works. It's easy to lose and it's impossible to get back. And that was the sex education that was offered at my public high school in Raleigh, North Carolina, circa like 2003.
That's so abstract.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I was lucky. My parents sent me to the Our Whole Lives, which is the sex education that's offered through the Unitarian Universalist Church program. And they were very queer friendly, very pro-choice, very consent forward, very anti-shame. And I remember learning about disability and sex, people of all sizes having sex, how to communicate. That was incredible. Yeah, but it was a private program that my parents had to pay for, and it was offered through my church. And that's not the kind of sex ed that all of the churches are offering.
I don't know any church that would – all of the church. I don't know any church that would offer
Shout
that.
Out to the Unitarians, man.
I know my family – I have family members that have been Unitarians, and I've just – I've always thought positive things about – I no shade – to Unitarians. Anyway, they're pretty cool. And that is very cool. But I feel like this age verification thing, like are they putting that on websites where not just like hardcore pornography websites, but also like on
sex education.
Yeah. Is that also happening?
And the answer is yes, because when you talk to legislators about what is it that they consider to be obscene, what is it that they consider to be content that's harmful to minors, they include information about gender-affirming care. They include information about contraception. They include information about pleasure and masturbation and sexual health, right? These are folks that genuinely believe that we corrupt children by giving them access to information. And yeah. And the other thing that I think is important for folks to understand is, and this is important because these are the kinds of conversations, like I hang out with smart, well-meaning people, right? Like me and my husband, like that's our cool hangs only. And a lot of my peers have genuine and earnest and well-meaning questions around like, well, I don't want 13-year-olds to be able to just access hardcore pornography. And I hear that. I genuinely do.
Yeah.
However, creating age verification rules that apply to pornography specifically, I don't think people understand the like logistical or data, the ask of that, right? And how vulnerable all of our personal information is. uploading your ID to a third party in order to access a website is more dangerous than people watching other people have sex. It just is.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like a lack of education is more dangerous. I mean, you know, we see Billie Eilish is very vocal about anti-porn.
Yes.
She was also watching it as a young child trying to understand sex. And it's like, where were your parents? Where was the conversation?
Well, they're filling especially a hole.
Especially as a budding famous person who will be sitting in front of interviewers who are sexually harassed children regularly, particularly our young females artists. Yeah. So, like, I don't understand. It's educational. I know porn isn't ideal for children to watch, but it is what people are doing.
It's better than a complete lack of information, right? We know this, right? Sex educators, people that study this issue, people have an idea in their mind that we're somehow protecting children by withholding or denying access to information, when in reality, not being able to access that information, not having language about it, creates the conditions for vulnerability to all kinds of exploitation and abuse, right? We see this in the Catholic Church. We see this in the Protestant Church. We see this in all of the most repressive communities are rife with interpersonal violence, sexual abuse of children.
Right.
And the best way to prevent your child from being sexually exploited is to tell them the real names of their body parts. You know, I heard, I was, scrolling through Twitter and I follow folks and they post like, so-and-so was convicted of sexually harassing a minor. So-and-so was, arrested for sexually exploiting young children. And it's police officers and ministers. That seems to be most of the people that are committing this work. And I heard a horrible story about a young girl. I think she was 4 or 5 years old. And she was being sexually exploited. I don't remember if it was from at her school or from her church, but somebody in her community was touching her, but she had been taught that her bot to call her vulva her cookie. And so when she reported that someone was touching her cookies for too long, they believed that this was a lunchbox dispute issue and did not understand what was happening. And it's our own shame, right? We're projecting our own shame onto our children, and it's preventing them from being able to ask for what they want or stand up to predators.
Wow. Yeah. For me, when I was a child, we didn't have the internet, but I still had access to porn. We're gonna find it. We children just get their hands into shit and you can't stop them. I mean, I was looking at adults. I was looking at pornography, magazines and stuff when I was 10 years old.
Yep.
And not understanding. And then my friends, their parents had homemade porn. And they knew, our friends knew where it was stashed, and we snuck that shit and watched it.
I don't know. I feel like the
porn when I was 10.
Yeah, but that's not just porn. That's like you watch it your neighbors, right?
Granted, it's ethically not the greatest thing to be. We were 10 years old. We were drinking snops. We were highly unsupervised.
I remember. I mean, I was drawing. I was obsessed with drawing naked. In the third grade, I went through this phase where I'd go to the art museum with my little charcoal and pen and draw all of the Greek statues, with a huge focus on genitalia.
My parents had the Joy of Sex book on their bookshelf.
It's a classic.
That was a good one too.
Anise Nin Erotica was my intro. I don't know if I recommend that path. It's fine.
Sounds a little.
Yeah, interest. And that's the thing. It's interest in sex is pathologized when it's actually the most normal thing in the world.
Well, I don't even understand that. I mean, it's literally how we exist.
Right.
Why can't we talk about it?
We pretend that sex is violence and we pretend that violence is sex.
I mean, those two things can be, but it's not all there is.
Correct.
Yeah, it's they just took this thing, sex, and they're it's bad. It's just bad all around.
Right.
Just don't do it unless you're going to pop a baby out.
Right. Right.
But it's so fun.
Right. And it's good for you. It's good for your skin. It reduces your risk of cancer. It's good for your joints. Like, all of the benefits of weightlifting times 10. Like,
right.
Sex is good for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Masturbation is good for you. But throughout history, a lot of smart, well-meaning people seem to genuinely believe that people enjoying themselves by themselves is like the problem with society. And the age verification laws are coming from the same place as the end demand laws. We say we're protecting children. We say we're protecting women when in fact we are trying to eradicate the oldest profession.
Right, right. So speaking of history, you in your one of your presentations that you do, you talk about an experiment with monkeys and money.
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
Do you mind sharing?
Is it not okay at all. It's one of my favorite facts. Yes, of course. Absolutely.
And it's real. So, it's a real story, right?
This is real.
Okay.
So I have a live show called Whore's Eye View, where I cover 10,000 years of history from a sex worker's perspective. But really, it's millions of years from history from a sex worker's perspective, because I start with monkeys. And so, you know, scientists or economists or zoologists or whoever, whatever department it was, probably an interdepartment thing at Yale, spent who knows how much money teaching captive monkeys what money is. And so they set up a little monkey store where monkeys could exchange tokens for grapes, which monkeys love, especially in a closed economy.
So cute.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. So they had like a little monkey store, and like, you know, the monkey would come with their little grape or their little token, and then they would get like a grape. And as soon as the concept clicked, right, as soon as monkeys attached value to these tokens that they'd been given, the first thing that happened, the first observed behavior, was that a boy monkey gave a girl monkey a token and then they had sex. It's the first thing that happened.
It sounds natural to me.
Right. And we've observed this behavior in all kinds of species of birds, including, I think, most famously penguins, a wide variety of primates, including, like, you know, multiple species of monkeys. And we know from early human history that sex for meat, sex for something of value, using sex to get your needs met, this is not a uniquely human or sort of like post-capitalist tactic.
Certainly not. I'm a huge fan of these Planet Earth shows, series, you know what I mean? And I think it's Planet Earth 2, and they show this particular marine mammal, and it's like a funny-looking dolphin. It's not your typical dolphin, and it's got like a long snout, John. It's pretty long. Mm-hmm. And they go, the males, only the males, go to the bottom of the floor, and they pick out shiny rocks.
Yes.
And they place them inside of their snout, and they lift themselves out of the water very slowly to display the shiny rock.
Amazing.
And that's to get a female to come and have sex with him. So he's literally like, look, girl, I got this diamond. You know, like trading shiny rocks for sex in the
ocean. Same thing. Crows do this. I forget. I mean, it's probably a bunch of different species of birds, right? Where the male goes and like collects shiny, beautiful things and like builds a house. And then, you know, like the female of the species comes around and is like, do I want to live in this house or not? I mean, it's a fair and reasonable question.
Oh, it's so good. So you've been doing this work for a long time now. And like, are you headed back to like legislation type rooms and meetings? Like, what's your work like?
That's a great question. So I started my career as a stand-up comedian, right? Touring clubs and colleges all over the country. And then I became the director of communications for decriminalized sex work. And that's when I started talking to legislators and policymakers and, you know, nonprofit boards and media in a more serious way. But after years of doing that work, it became really clear to me that we are not going to get good policy change on this issue unless and until we get cultural change on this issue, right? We can't change the laws until we change the stories. And so I've been really focused on cultural change over the course of the last couple of years, specifically talking about sex work through the lens of history. Right.
Okay.
So, you know, sitting down talking to legislators, when you start talking about sex work, everyone pictures their daughter, right? That's like the first thing that happens, like the real or hypothetical daughter doing this work. And I want to shift the conversation to reminding people that a lot of us have grandmothers that have done this work. And it changes the story. It becomes a cool survival tactic, right? It becomes an entrepreneurial journey. It becomes a great family story. And people are able to look at, you know, the options that their grandmothers had and say, like, yes, this makes sense. And I think it re-centers the conversation outside of the like moral technological panic that we're having of the day. Becomes less about like the internet or Snapchat or AI or like whatever legislators are most afraid of, and places it back in its place of like, no, this has been a thing that's been a part of all of our communities for literally the whole time. And the technology changes, but the details really don't.
Right.
And so, you know, I do that through the Oldest Profession podcast, where every episode we do a deep dive on a different sex worker from history. And I do that through the live show, where I cover 10,000 years of history from a sex worker's perspective. And a huge amount of the work that we do at Old Pros is encouraging sex workers, right, to reclaim our legacy and reminding, you know, policymakers and just people in the community that we have always been and we will always be here. So that's our focus. So we lend assistance, you know, to, you know, sex worker advocates. If you think it would be helpful for, you know, me to testify, I travel all over the world. I'm happy to do that. But we've sort of stepped back from like the churning of like the legislative cycle and individual bills towards larger, broader public education.
That makes a lot of sense, because this younger generation is moving into office.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
And we want them to move in with real world education. Yes. Real world meaning from the people who are doing it.
Correct.
Not from anecdotal things you see on the internet or just some one random person you know talk to one stripper one night, you know?
Like, right.
Actually being immersed in events like yours. It's awesome. And I'm curious, have you had people come up to you like after a show and been like, wow, you changed my mind?
Yeah, I have.
Okay,
and
it's about that.
One of the most moving experiences
that
you can have on the road. I mean, obviously I love connecting to sex workers, and I love like hearing old pro stories and learning about like sex workers from history in every city that we travel to. But hands down, my favorite like demographic of audience is when someone brings their parent or like somebody else in their life who isn't sure, and they come up to me and tell me that I changed their mind. That like that is why I do this work, right? I love bringing people together. I love, you know, like rallying the troops. Actually, I don't love war analogies, but you know what I mean. Like speaking to, you know, speaking to the choir. I love that. It feels really good. But I really love moving people out of this deep, dark, entrenched false belief about like what sex work is and what sex is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. That must feel really good. And that's the whole point of doing this work is, yes, we want to talk to our people, but like even for this podcast, like I like hearing when a non-stripper or sex worker is listening to it, because I'm like, oh, you're learning, you know?
Yes.
And particularly men should listen.
Super helpful.
Yeah.
I feel like I've really kind of zeroed in on moms, right? And like maybe that's my own like family trauma, like so many artists. We're just doing our, you know, like family stuff. Mm-hmm. And also I think that like self-identified progressive women that consider themselves to be feminists, who really want to be right on this issue, is the most important demographic to move, right? Like anti-sex conservatives are natural enemies, right? Like if you're not with us on abortion, if you're not with us on like LGBTQ plus rights, like if you don't think trans people should exist, sure, it feels consistent that you're also like sex work, ew, fine. But if you're a pro-choice feminist who is spending any of your time and money and energy fighting to make life harder for sex workers, you've missed the boat. Like this is – a misapplication of these core 100%. Ideas.
Because they are so tenacious and they they're effective and they're efficient and they're intelligent.
And they think they're right.
And they think they're right. So I'm just like, if you could just hone your skills and ability and talent towards doing actual good that we need.
Bring your moms to my show. Send my podcast to your moms. You know, like it's we play respectability politics, right? There's not that much cursing. I try to keep things within the navigational beakers. I mean, you said yourself, right? Like I have this background as a stand-up comedian. I've worked as a shock jock before. That is not the vibe that we've developed at Old Pros, right? We are meant to be an accessible platform, and we hope to act as a resource for people's first touch on this issue. Yeah. There are no stupid questions at Old Pros.
Yeah. No, that's awesome.
Also,
Your work is incredible. And it's so fun watching you on stage. You're hilarious. And like, just felt like being in the dressing room, which I miss so much. I feel like I say that every episode. It was such a blast watching you. And also I did want to talk about before we, while I have you, the Gilgo Beach special.
Yeah, on ABC.
So much. Yes. For anyone who is unaware, the Gilgo Beach murders were serial killing murders that happened in Long Beach Island or Long Island?
Long Island. New York, New Jersey, Long Island.
Yeah. And you were a guest on the ABC special. Can you share with our audience a little bit about
that? Yeah, I would love it. It was such an honor to be asked to do that. And I think it's really important work that isn't for everyone, right? Because the reality of that, ABC documentary is they did a lot of things that, you know, ABC documentaries do, right? They sensationalize the violence. It's a lot of B-roll of, you know, like people in heels and marshes and, you know, really sort of playing up how dangerous sex work is without a critical analysis to how criminalization makes us more vulnerable to that violence. And, you know, if you look at all of the interviews that they did, I really feel like I got to kind of, I guess sneak in there isn't quite the right word, but try to bring that narrative to light. And so, you know, a lot of what I said was left on the cutting room floor, but they did give me like one of the last words. And I think that I was able to articulate that, like, when you're thinking about why serial killers target sex workers, it's not because sex work is inherently violent. It's that we are more vulnerable to predators because we are members of a criminalized class.
Right.
We can't report violence committed against us. And increasingly, we can't even take safety precautions without risking arrest, which is just another form of violence.
Sesta Fosta, Elimination Backpage, et cetera. Yeah.
So bad.
Horrible.
You know, Sesta Fosta is actually impacting sex workers all over the world.
No, it doesn't surprise me at all.
I just came from, I toured my show in New Zealand and across Australia, and I got to meet sex workers and hang out with people. And, you know, New South Wales decriminalized sex work in 1995, and New Zealand decriminalized sex work in 2003. So they have, like, human rights. They are not members of it. They're going into like our second generation of sex workers that feel very comfortable reporting violence committed against them.
Good.
Reporting. There was a case in New Zealand. A fantastic young sex worker successfully sued her brothel manager for sexual harassment. For like trying to, anyway, the sex workers of New Zealand are amazing. However, in the immediate aftermath of Sesta Fosta, they can't be on social media. They're having their accounts banned. They're even being denied access to payment platforms because of policies that are coming out of the United States.
Yeah,
it's egregious.
Because the social media apps are on our US run.
Of course.
Right?
Yes.
And I mean, that's the whole thing with TikTok right now, is it's the only social media platform that is not regulated by the United States government. It's literally the only one, which makes so much sense why they want to take it away from us under the guise of like all this other shit. I don't even believe them. Anyway, it doesn't surprise me at all because like all of the platforms changed. So they would have to comply no matter what country they live in, but also getting denied banking even in their country.
Yeah. So the problem is that New Zealand doesn't have a lot of like banks. So they're dependent on other countries. And so like, you know, when Visa, MasterCard, like these big international, right global banking, it's their policies are sort of like trumping local policies. So you can have like a legal licensed business. You can be like not operating outside of the law locally. But we also see that with legal content creators here, you know, like OnlyFans or porn performers or like people, you know, even people that are working in strip clubs, like, these folks are having their bank accounts shut down or being like systematically denied access to banking technology and investment platforms in the name of protecting us from our own choices. Right.
It's ridiculous. I used to like, I used to plan out when I would go to the bank. Like I would like not bring too much money at one time or I would I'd be like, oh, I already dropped like 3 G's in the bank last week. Like I have to wait another 2 weeks, because if I keep walking in with this cash, and I even asked the teller straight up once, I was like, y'all watch me bringing cash in here? You watching me? And they're like, no, what are you talking about? No, we bring one. It's not the smartest thing to ask them, but I was just like,
I get it though. Yeah.
I just wanted to know.
And it's so silly, right? Because like we get discriminated against as like women or queer presenting folks, right? Like people think nothing of dudes walking in with like tens of thousands of dollars, like cash check or whatever. But, you know, if you look like somebody who could be doing sex work, and it's frustrating for me too, because women who, you know, have never engaged in sex work face the same kind of discrimination and it doesn't turn them against whorephobia. It turns them against sex workers, right? So you'll hear folks that are like, well, if, you know, if sex workers didn't exist, then I wouldn't get catcalled. And I'm like, well, ma'am, that is not science. That's not true. Yeah. They're like, well, they think I'm a whore. I'm like, that's not what's happening.
No. I've been literally been like covered in sweatpants and a hoodie head to toe. And I'm getting catcalled. But yeah, and we've also are seeing a similar conversation happening in like the strip clubs and whatnot, because there's different levels of sex work happening inside of the strip clubs. And then some of the dancers are getting upset with the other dancers who are doing offering extras more for less. As opposed to really, you know, analyzing the system and how the system is literally pitting us against us, against each other, so that we don't go as far. We don't get as far in trying to preserve or even like build any autonomy or safety or anything. We can't, because now we're just fighting with each other. Well, you're more of a whore than I am. And it's like, well, that's the hierarchy. Right. And
that's not correct. Helping. Yeah. It's the hierarchy. And you're not, you know, you're not building yourself up by cutting somebody else down. But like the criminalized nature of this work, it lends to that. Right. Like, and you see the same tensions across labor movements, right? Okay. Like people are higher up on the totem pole, like shitting on people lower on the totem pole. And it creates, I mean, you know, this cartoon has been reproduced since I think the medieval period, right? With like kings and serfs, but you know, like the king or the bank or the capitalist or like whatever, you know, takes 99% of the pie and then throws the crumbs on the table and is like, that guy's trying to take your guy's share. And it's like, well, that's not the whole story.
We're
fighting over crumbs because where did the rest of the cake go? You know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's a really good analogy. That's,
yeah.
Wow. So, so you're on
that's
tour.
As true. Oh yeah, yeah. Thank you.
I want to make sure we talk about it because you're all over the place.
It's true. Yeah. So I'm in New York. For the next 3 weeks, I don't know when this episode comes out, but I have shows at the Laurie Beachman Theater, or if you are in the New York area, it's on 42nd and 9th. I love this theater. I hope it's okay for me to gush about it.
Please do.
It's in the heart of the theater district, right, on 42nd Street and 9th Avenue, but it feels like a secret because you have to walk through the West Bank restaurant to like and like go down this stairwell, and then it opens up into this beautiful cabaret theater. Like Joan Rivers has performed there. Annie Sprinkle has performed there. Joe Weldon has performed there. So I'm so excited that I get to be a part of this theater's pro sex worker history.
That's so rad. Yeah, this episode is coming out in a few days. So
fantastic. Great. Yeah, so if you're in New York, come check me out. Yeah. I'm also going to be in Charleston and Denver and Orlando. We're looking at dates in DC, San Francisco, LA, Boston, New Hampshire. I'm also going to Reykjavik, Iceland, which is really exciting.
That is
You used to live in Iceland.
I used to live in Iceland.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. I'm going to Edinburgh, Scotland. I'm going to Oxford, England. I love Edinburgh.
It's so beautiful. Oh, you're going to love Edinburgh.
I'm so excited. We're looking at dates. We don't have them confirmed yet in Berlin, Budapest, Lisbon, Vienna. So, yeah. And if you would like me, if you have a theater or know somebody who has a theater or a venue, reach out. Like we are trying to take this show to as many places and as many people as humanly possible. So email me, reach out, and let's talk about how we can put a show together. And if any of those places are where you're at, or we're always adding new dates, and you can find all of that at whoreseyeview.com.
Well, I'm super impressed. I think that's amazing that you're on so much tour. When are you being like broadcast is on television?
Not yet. No, that is the end goal. Yeah. So ideally, we would like to get the show on a streaming platform, right? With the objective of like getting it in front of as many people as possible. But what's happening in the meantime is everywhere that I go, I'm connecting to sex workers and sex worker rights advocates, and I'm getting to like tour brothels in places where it's decriminalized and like hear about how it's going in places that have criminalized clients. And you know, I'm really looking forward to, you know, coming back, having seen examples. I mean, we're going to Norway, we're going to Iceland, we're going to Canada. Like, I get to see how the end demand policies are playing out. I've gotten to see decriminalization. I'm excited to go to Amsterdam and, you know, Nevada and look at what legalization actually looks like. But, you know, it's one thing to study this issue, and it's another to meet people and talk to people who day in, day out have to live with these policies.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh my God. I'm like just overwhelmed with inspiration and like joy for what you're experiencing. Just so, so cool. Like, all I want is to hang out with strippers and sex workers.
Yes.
Like, the only people I want to hang out with.
We're the coolest, and we have been across time. Yeah. Anything and like anything cool in all of human history, if you scratch the surface a little bit, you will find sex workers there, right? We would not have jazz without, like, you know, the brothels of Storyville.
We've been hip-hop.
Right, correct.
The dancers of Atlanta.
Yes. You know? Yes. We don't just create culture, we are culture.
Exactly. Yeah. Unreal. So cool. Please tell everyone exactly how to find you.
Absolutely. The best way to keep up with all of our work is to get on our email list. You can sign up to stay in the know like an old pro at oldprosonline.org. Every week, we send up a roundup of sex worker rights related news from around the world, in addition to new podcasts coming out, old podcasts we want to highlight because they suddenly become relevant in the news cycle again, which, you know, Comstock keeps coming up, unfortunately. And also, of course, upcoming live dates, including Whore's Eye View, public debates, or public speaking that I do. And you can hear about all of that through our newsletter. Please check out our website. Follow us online at oldprosonline.org or at oldprosonline on social media.
Final thought, if someone's mom is listening.
Let's see. Yeah, that's a great question. That immediately brings other questions, right? Like, do you suspect that your child is a sex worker? Do you know? What's your deal? So speaking to a parent who has like just found out that their child is a sex worker, you have been told by society, that that means a lot of things about your kid that it just doesn't. And so sex worker rights are where gay rights were in like the late 1960s. So we used to believe that homosexuality was not only a crime, but a disease, a kind of pathology. And we've been told really similar things about sex work. But the first woman to run for president in the United States was a sex worker. Victoria Woodhull announced her candidacy in 1870. Some of the most successful entrepreneurs, innovators, philanthropists, and artists spent time as a sex worker. Being a sex worker is a lot like being a waitress. It's, you know, a job that a lot of folks do to get through a rough patch. And it doesn't mean anything about you or your kid, because all kinds of people have done sex work for all kinds of reasons. And so long as your kid can always come home, that's the thing that's going to keep them safe. It's not like doing or not doing sex work. It's knowing that they have a safe place to land, hopefully with a non-judgmental parent like you.
That was really great. Thank you.
Thanks.
What an honor. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. And thank you to our audience, as always, for tuning in. This is one of the best episodes, I think, that I've ever done. You're amazing. And this is such helpful, important information for so many people out there. And it's like reinvigorating my own advocacy work that I do. It's hard to not feel burnt out. So this was really invigorating. Thank you.
Thank you. I really take that in. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I mean, you know this, running a podcast or doing an email, it can sometimes feel like shouting into an empty cave. Yeah. So it really mm-hmm. means the world because the work that you're doing here is so important. I've listened to a few episodes, and like these conversations, we are all contributing to the destigmatization of this work. And together, we can change the story about sex work.
And that's on Period Network.